which is in part looking at this really, I guess we're looking at this very central human process of working with the deep imagination in an embodied way that continually gets lost or corrupted in some way. And it's a very ancient problem. I mean, it's as ancient back as the time of Setne, where things are forgotten, things become institutionalized, things get lost. Now, it's interesting, the time of Setne is an interesting time, because it's where you get in Egypt, you get one man's vision. It happens to be the powerful man, the most powerful man, because Egypt is a very centralized state. But he has a vision. His vision eclipses all other visions. And it's kind of interesting, really, the whole area of Akhenaton in the 19th century and early 20th century was Akhenaton was seen as being this wonderful revolutionary figure who was prefiguring monotheism, and who therefore was regarded as being in advance of the ignorant Egyptians of that time, who couldn't handle his glorious kind of ideas. And it's really interesting how ideas from the past get picked up by, you know, because at the time when this is sort of Egyptology really comes to the fore, late 19th century, early 20th century, a time of the great empires, and when Christianity has great hegemony over the whole world. And he's seen as being a proto-Christian, as being a sort of prefiguring figure of Christianity who got rid of all the superstition of the past. Was actually what we've learned as Egyptology has developed is actually he was a total disaster for Egypt. He weakened the country. There was famine. He was a dictator, and his religious system was all about I am the king. I am God. My children and my wife are also gods. The rest of you are there to serve us. And it's a sort of, in a way, quite fascistic image, but it's a great image of the idea that one truth, one aspect of truth, where he's looking at the the beauty and the power of light, but that light driving everything else out. So it's in a way this world we live in today, where people know the truth. You know, it's the whole fake news. Everything is fake news because I know what is true. Well, and I don't have to think about it, I don't have to reflect, I don't have to dialogue with anybody, I know the truth.
It's something about, this is the trouble with monotheism, is this whole thing of taking something out of time, out of cyclical movement and the seasons and reality into this other neverland.
Yeah, that's right.
Dissociation, almost, you could call it.
Yeah, completely. And I think we see secular versions of that these days, where something condenses around an idea, and a lot of the ideas that you find happening are the purity of the race, which is essentially, there's no such thing as the purity of any race in human history. But what happens is, whether it's in the Nazis or whether it's in Hungary or whether it's with Trump, Trump's interesting, actually, because he's such a creature of the zeitgeist. I mean, he really reflects these disturbed energies that are emerging, whatever he is as a human being. He's certainly a vehicle for those kind of energies. You know, it's an extraordinary thing he's doing at the moment, where he's building a wall, wants to build a wall to stop the thousands of South Americans who are going to invade, and some of the images, the horrible images that have been conjured up about that, about seeing the South Americans as vermin, as coming to strip our wealth, strip our kind of, you know, and sell us all drugs, and it's a sort of extraordinary kind of.
Nazi Germany.
It's exactly the same propaganda. Yeah. It's exactly the same. The same thing they would say about they used to say about Jews, right? And the sort of it's an idea that then sort of coalesces it becomes completely separated off from any truth or dialogue. There's no dialogue available to this, you know, And in a way, it's kind of interesting, because these images often do coalesce around the image of a great man, Not so many examples of women doing this, but you know, so Akhenaten is the great man of his time. His vision is the great vision of his time. He drives out the gods, which means he drives out the archetypes. He drives out the multiplicity of viewpoints. Right, so strips all that out. Egypt as a country is virtually destroyed, and then they have to kind of recover themselves. Now, what happens is interesting. You know, you get a whole kind of period. And interestingly, in Egypt, what happens is that Egypt enters a golden age as they recover themselves, as they reclaim their own god, their old god, their capacity to imagine, their capacity to create. It becomes more powerful than ever it was before. Like all human institutions, Egypt falls apart eventually. Although it keeps having these kind of extraordinary revivals. Ali and I were down in Sudan in the autumn, because right at the just before the Greco-Egyptian period that comes, which is a mere 1800 years ago, 2000 years ago probably, just before the Christian era, the Kushite kings, which are the kings of Nubia, effectively take over Egypt. But they take over Egypt in order to restore Egypt to its ancient ways, because they are believers in the old way, in the old ways of Egypt. And that there's something about that. There's something of the place that Egypt holds in the human imagination that keeps on happening. Now, what happens to Egypt is eventually Christianity is the death knell of this particular religious tradition. You get well into the Christian era, you still get temples operating, in particular the temple of Isis at Philae near the high dam at Aswan, right up in the south of Egypt. But eventually even that place gets closed and Christianity takes over. Now, I mean, this is not a historical weekend, but there's a huge process that happens in the development of Christianity that shuts down the idea of the multiplicity of views. Because Christianity, ultimately, in the way that it gets taken up in the West in particular, is built upon the cult of the Roman Emperor, in particular the cult of the Emperor Constantine. And it's the same kind of image it's built in the image of a great man. So we have a father God and his son, and we have a set of doctrines that have to be believed in order to be good, in order to be received into heaven, in order to live a good life. You must believe this. So these older ideas, which have a lot of flexibility and multiplicity in them, and a lot of possibilities for human vision, become successively shut down. Now, one of the things you see happening, particularly in Western Europe in particular, less so in the Middle East with Islam, whereas Christianity is the dominant paradigm, you enter this whole period called the Dark Ages, where all kinds of knowledge gets lost. This is an astonishing kind of period where in Britain, for example, sort of old Roman remains at certain points are conceived of as being buildings made by fairies or ancient gods, because people don't know how to make things anymore. Secret of glass is lost. You know, you get a whole kind of a process of shutting down and exclusion of anything that isn't regarded as Christian.
Well, it was that sort of their knowledge then only went back two generations.
Yeah.
So they had no idea of any history at all. So.
No, there's a point in Anglo-Saxon history where Bath, just up the road here, is regarded as this haunted city. They didn't used to like to live where the Romans lived, because they thought it was the remote place of gods or elves. So a lot of the old Roman places just fall into decay and it's an extraordinary thought, isn't it? Bath, which was one of the central cities of Romano-Celtic Britain, is shunned, and is people don't live there because it's sort of, you know, that's where the elves live, and that's where the spirits live. You know, it is this very powerful idea, but it's symptomatic of a kind of a narrowing of human understanding and experience. And it happens not just to the kind of things like Egypt. The ancient Greek knowledge is lost, all the kind of mathematical knowledge, all the kind of the ways of understanding the world that the Greek philosophers had gets lost as well.
Perspective.
People don't know how to use perspective anymore. There's all kinds of human talents that just vanish because they're regarded as non-Christian and kind of and what's important. And side by side, you get this image of the world is not important. The thing that most matters is not to beautify the world. Is to glorify God and go to heaven. Find ways to go to heaven. And, you know, of course, this is a massively manipulated system, of course, because the Roman Church is very kind of centrist and very kind of powerful, you know, secularly powerful. So these structures get used as structures of domination. And in particular, there's a whole kind of process that happens that's around making sure that the human imagination doesn't stray outside the orthodox theological norms. Which is why you get things like the idea of the development of the Holy Inquisition So in a certain sense, the human imagination is confined to a particular set of images and ideas and possibilities. So it gets very, very narrowed, and the sanctions around this are very, very strong. And where you see occasionally kind of in southern France, for example, and you get the development of Languedoc, which is a different kind of Christianity that has different aspects to it, partly because it's also quite a rich place. You get this enormous crusade that comes sweeping down from northern France into southern France, that absolutely devastates the thing called the Catholic Crusade, where thousands of people get killed in order to bring everything back into line. So I don't think we can quite imagine the brutality of that these days, and the sort of domination of the. You have to imagine that if you lived in that society, you had to go to church. Right? You had to be seen to be a good Christian. And if you were not seen as a good Christian, there were serious sanctions that could happen to you. You know, you could be fined, you could be hurt, you could be imprisoned. There's a way in which these days Christianity can seem a bit feeble and a bit benign. But that's only because it's lost its secular power. You know, I mean, if you look at Ireland, Southern Ireland, even today, you look at the issues about contraception, the issues about abortion. You look at the Bible states and in the states and the pressure on the U.S. Constitution around abortion. You can just start to see the power of that belief system when it has power. You know, it's authoritarian and it's universal, because it's regarded as universally true, because only one point of view is true. So that's great danger in a way. Yeah, it is, but it's worse than McCarthyism in a way, because it's eternal, it's everlasting, right? This McCarthyism is a political dogma, and you can see roots in it. Whereas this is the way the world has always been. This is the way the world is always going to be, mm-hmm. Right? You know, and it's interesting, because a lot of the end and the imaginal structures in these Christianity are perversions of ancient Egyptian ideas. So, for example, you get a big image in Christianity is the burning in eternal fire. Now, in the Egyptian tradition, you get the dead have to pass through the lake of fire, which is a purification process and a healing process. But there's one kind of all the details, which would take us too long, but there are lots of, in some of the ancient Egyptian books that describe the afterworld, the other life, which is also a description of the collective unconscious. The Egyptians are brilliant at mapping the deep structures of the human collective. And you find a lot of the similarity between these ideas and some of these Christian ideas. But the difference is, in the Egyptian process, it's a cyclic process of transformation. So the lake of fire is something you would pass through until it becomes a lake of sweet cold water, until you have worked something through. In the Christian version of it, you're condemned to live in the lake of fire forever, because you had your chance and you've blown it. Okay, you're outside the circle of the good. You're with the damned now forever.
The Greeks did that there, being Sisyphus. stopped really nothing.
No, that's right. That's right.
Jesus never stopped having his liver.
He didn't, no. So there are all these, you see these, but it's interesting there, because you see, if you look at that, you look at the rise of Zeus as the god king. So you get this kind of, even in Greek tradition, you get these figures, these quite patriarchal kind of figures. Whereas in Egyptian tradition, you've got a blend of maleness and femaleness, and sort of, and it's a very different tradition in some ways. But what you start to see is as these older ideas pass away, and as developments, as patriarchal ideas in particular, you see the domination of the man god, who is central and everybody has to obey. If you look at the roots of Greek religion, archaic Greek religion, it's not like that at all. And in fact, there's some very early forms of Zeus, where Zeus is seen as a hermaphrodite. He's Zeus Parthenogenetus. We find there's temples to him in Asia Minor, where Zeus has breasts and a vagina, and kind of, and you know, so but all that starts to go away as you move away from the Homeric period, which is, you get this kind of, suddenly he becomes the man, the bearded man with the kind of who throws the thunderbolt and can kill anybody because he can do that.
It's interesting you use the word hermaphrodite, which you're describing that as
yes.
Two gender, they're coming together through that alchemical thing.
Yeah.
Also, if you break down the word hermaphrodite, it's Hermes and
Aphrodite combined.
Together.
Yes, that's right, exactly. Yeah, no, totally. So there are things. So there are, and that's one of the interesting things that you see is alongside these external kind of oppressive traditions, you find this and these underground traditions are still, they're still connecting back into these older ideas. I mean, one particular strand I thought is, and the hermaphrodite thing is part of this, is the idea of alchemy. Now, the word alchemy is an Arabic word. It means alchem, which means, al means art. It means the art of chem, which is the art of Egypt. And so Egypt, as time passes on, becomes this place of magic, this place where they understood the mysteries of transformation. And it remains as this kind of underground thread in the West up until around the 14th, 15th century. Now, it's never entirely lost. Even before then, you have these underground and these groups. You have sort of, you have various Christian groups, Jewish groups. You have it much more overtly, actually, in Islam, where there's still the bizarre, oddly, given the position Islam has ended up in our time, in that Dark Ages period, Islam is the enlightened, progressive, scientifically advanced culture, where the Greek learning, the Egyptian learning funnels into Islam. And so elsewhere, so algebra is another word, Arabic word for the development of mathematics that comes out of the Arab world. So the West is sunk really in this kind of Christian kind of paradigm that stops creativity. It's all going on in the Middle East. And what happens really in it's to Italy where we owe really the Renaissance, the beginning of new life arising in the West. Because what happens is that you get this movement in Italy that's called the humanists. So it's the who are interested in human beings, human knowledge, interested in breaking out of the shackles of the Catholic Church, effectively. And they're able to do this because the city states of Italy are themselves city states; they're sovereign. And a number of quite remarkable people, like the Medici, come to power, who are intelligent, interested, have political interest in weakening the power of the Pope, because they want to be, because they're quite clear, you know, if you're in Italy at that time, you're very close up to Rome. So you've got a real vested interest in establishing independence of Rome so as not to be dominated by the demands of the Pope. Now, what happens at this point really is the Medici in particular and a remarkable man called Massilio Finicio sets up something he calls the Platonic Academy of Florence. Now, which one is it? Lorenzo Medici. I can't quite remember. I'll check this and tell you tomorrow. But I think it's Lorenzo the Magnificent, Lorenzo Magnifico, who is one of the great figures of the Medici, who's interested in learning and hears that there's all this information in the Arab world and pays for vast amounts of manuscripts to be brought to Florence in order to be translated. So there's Latin manuscripts, there's Greek manuscripts, there's things that are being literally excavated out of the older world that have been preserved in Islam that come into Florence and become the foundation for this notion of the Renaissance, the renewal, the bringing back of the lost ways of thinking and being. There's all kinds of things like, you know, this kind of mathematics, geometry, understanding of things like perspective starts to happen. But also what comes is a different understanding of the human imagination and the humanity's part in this. Because what comes is the writings of the Platonists and the Neoplatonists. Now, there's a convergence that happens here, because at the same time, for some hundreds of years in Europe, there have been Jews studying the Kabbalah, which is also links back to some of the older Greek traditions, and you get this kind of fusion happening between Jewish ideas, Greek ideas, ultimately Egyptian ideas, because of something called the Corpus Hermeticum, which are wisdom dialogues that come out of Egypt. So all this comes together in a great melting pot. I don't know if you've ever been to Florence. Florence is this little city. Yes, you can walk around Florence very easy. It's an amazing place. But in this small, confined city, walled city, suddenly all these different streams of human imagination and possibility were coming together. So the Renaissance is one of these great explosions of creativity, where things come together. And in particular, I'll read you a couple of excerpts of the Corpus Hermeticum, because there's some quite interesting ideas, really.
The dialogues of that, Ian.
Yeah.
That would have come out of the real back end of Egyptian.
Yeah.
As it was turning in, well, they weren't using hieroglyphs anymore, they were using Greek and...
Well, some people will still have understood, at that point, some people will still have understood hieroglyphs, right?
Yeah.
Right. So the in Alexandria, at least in Ptolemaic Egypt, they still understood hieroglyphs, but it was getting lost. I mean, the whole thing was vanity.
Is that some sort of Rosetta Stone?
Because it was...
They
didn't have the original. It comes down in Demotic Greek. Right, so you have only, it's all the only examples of you have it now in Greek. So you basically have to imagine a load of Greek and Latin manuscripts turning up in Florence, and Massilio Fenicio and his companions translating them, and getting in a way blown away by the possibilities that are emerging there. And
the libraries burned.
Yes, they were. The Romans burned a lot of the big library of Alexandria was burned by the Romans. A lot of the temple libraries were also burned by the Romans, because when Rome took over Egypt and when Augustus took over Egypt, Egypt got trashed because what Rome always did was to strip out what was sacred of another culture and re-establish it in Rome. So you'd have cults of Egyptian gods in Rome, but Romanized, and everything in the end was subservient to the cult of the empire, of the emperor. So you get a whole stripping away of things that then, of course, later get even lost further again as the whole Christian enterprise gets going. So this is a moment when things are coming back. And I'll just read you a version of one of the dialogues of the Corpus Hermeticum, because it just sort of gives an idea how mind blowing some of the ideas were. So this is an excerpt of one of the Hermetic dialogues. First of all, and without beginnings, is Atum. Atum Ra is the creator god. Second is the cosmos, made in his likeness. The cosmos is a second god. It is also an immortal being. And because everything in the cosmos is a part of the cosmos, it is impossible that any part of it should die. The cosmos is all life. From its first foundations, there's never existed a single thing which was not alive. There has not and has never been and never will be anything in the cosmos that is dead. Atum is light, everlasting source of energy, eternal dispenser of life. The cosmos has its being within the eternal energy from which all life emerges. It is impossible for it to stop or be destroyed. The cosmos dispenses this life to all things within it. Mind and soul are manifestations of light and life. Everything moves by the power of soul. The body of the cosmos is filled with soul. Soul is filled by mind. Mind is filled by Atum. Atum gives life to the great and perfect living creature which is the cosmos, which in turn gives life to all creatures. The cosmos is the whole. It generates and nourishes the parts like a parent, like a father caring for his child. It receives goodness from Atum, and this goodness is the true power. The cosmos is the image of Atum. Atum is all goodness. The cosmos is also good. So you have to imagine the impact of that on inquiring minds who have been living in a Christian universe. The genuinely mind-blowing, heart-expanding impact of something that is so different, that has such a different trajectory. And so, in a way, this partly explains why, you know, the explosion that is the Renaissance, the explosion of energy, the explosion of kind of creativity. And so what you find happening there is a whole set of kind of models and being created and sort of... And the other thing that happens at that same time, 15th century, is you find the tarot pack appearing. The Visconti Svolva pack. Sure. I thought I had it somewhere. What's in my bag? 15th century, around about 1499. So you get what you find. The first actual pack that we're aware of is something called the Visconti. This is the Fool from the Visconti Svolva pack. Visconti Svolva, V-I-S-C-O-N-T-I, Visconti Svolva, which is S-F. What's the say? I'll have to look at it here. S-F-O-R-Z-A. Svolva. Svolva. S-F-O-R-Z-A. Right, now this are a series. I mean, this is just obviously a printed card, but these are actually gold-illuminated miniature paintings. Now, what happens in the Renaissance is that the images of the old gods, the Greek and Roman gods, return, but return in a new way. Because the rather than being seen as external kind of images, they're seen as aspects of the human soul. Because the thing that above all that the Renaissance teachers are interested in is this idea of humanism. The idea that the human being, that the human being is central somewhere, and more important somewhere than any god, that actually so the old images of the gods are seen as aspects of the human spirit, and indeed this conceive of a different, as you find in the Corpus Hermeticum, the idea that actually God is not something that judges, something is more like an universal consciousness. So that's one of the ideas that starts to arise as well. We particularly get that from some of the Neoplatonic philosophers that are also coming back at this time. So you get this idea really that the returning of the old gods, the old images, but as aspects of the human spirit. And the idea of the universe as something that's alive, that's interconnected. Now, what they need at this point as well is a way of being able to study these things, study these emergent experiences, and create a needed to find a structure that will hold some of these ideas so they could look at them. In ancient Egypt, you have a whole vision, a whole image of the cosmos, and you have things called the books of the underworld, which give you an image of a creative cycle, which the Egyptians used to understand their experiences. Now, at the heart of the Egyptian experience, we've got this image of Genesis, that you find in Genesis also, of the tree of life. So you've got this very old Egyptian image of the tree, of the Ished tree, the ancient tree out of which all life comes, that is an image of the universe and an image of the human spirit. Now, in Judeo-Christian tradition, you have that same image, but it's a distorted image, because you have this image of the tree of life in the Bible, which is and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So you have the Genesis story in the Bible, which is this tree, which is found in the Garden of Perfection, the Garden of Eden, in which human beings are shut out from by disobeying divine law. So, one of the things that persists in an underground way is this capacity to work with the tree of life, the tree of perfection. In the Bible, it says you should not eat of the tree of life. If you eat of the tree of life, you will become as a god. And so a lot of in the work the Kabbalists, early Kabbalists were doing, Judeo-Kabbalists, were doing something heretical in that they were eating of the fruit of the tree of life, which means they were entering into this imaginative process that brings the world together, that doesn't split the world. Now, this exercise that we've been doing today about tapping into the tree of Heliopolis, tapping into the ancient waters, this is one of the central exercises of the Kabbalah and central exercises of the Western mystery tradition. You could just take that exercise and just keep working with it all your life, and it would develop into deeper and deeper ways. But it's that whole way of working that gets blown away and regarded as untrustworthy. You shall not do this. Because actually your role as a human being is to obey and to use whatever creativity you have in the service of your feudal overlords and Mother Church. And so that's what you're supposed to do. If you engage in this kind of work, it's profoundly subversive, because actually this is a deconstructive work that where you trust the creativity of the universe as it expresses itself through you. Now, one of the things that happens in the Renaissance is quite a lot of people who trust do that run into terrible trouble and end up burned and killed. In particular, Giordano Bruno was one of the great Renaissance philosophers who is killed. And there's a terrible kind of detail in his killing, in that out of kindness, somebody hammered a wooden wedge into his mouth to stop him speaking blasphemy, so he might escape hell. And there's something about that detail that's always struck me, because the person who did that actually thought they were helping him. Then they do this appallingly violent thing. So what you see happening in the Renaissance is this image of the tree of the idea of the tree of life of the images of the old gods starts to appear, not formed yet exactly properly, but it starts to recur. So you have Kabbalists, you have Christians, kind of playing with these ideas, working these things out. Hebrew is seen as a sacred language that connects you up with these ancient ideas. The word that we've been chanting, Yud He Shin Vav He, is a word that appears in the Renaissance. You won't find it actually in the older Jewish sources, because the name of God there is Yud He Vav He. But you get this image. So Yud He Shin Vav He is seen as being the image of the true human being. And this is because they're bringing forward an image of the human being who is the magician in the heart of the magic, who can unite the square and the circle, who can bring opposites together. Now, this is the old idea that we find in the Egyptian magician, who is the bringing, who possesses the book of Thoth, who possesses the capacity to work with all images, and who becomes part of the living creativity of the universe, who has become one with the book of Thoth, and who helps to steer the boat of the universe to create balance and peace and growth. Who is, in a way, a sort of a living philosopher's stone. And so there's this huge kind of need to, but you can't, of course, they can't do it in the old way, right? So what they're doing, what they're grappling with, you can imagine I don't think we can quite imagine the explosion of creativity and the dialogues that would have been happening between people at that time. You've got Leonardo doing his thing, you've got these extraordinary things happening in art, in particular in the religious sphere, we have Marcello Finicio as the master of the Platonic Academy. We've got another man called Pico della Mirandola, who is interested in the Kabbalah and saying, look, the Kabbalah can help with this, we can use these images that come out of Judeo-Christian tradition, we can use them in a new way. And at the same time, we have some genius creates the tarot pack. Don't know who. But somebody connected to the Visconti Sforza family creates this pack. Now, before this pack is created, there are lots of packs called the packs of triumphs. If it partly relate to Petrarch's triumphs, but I won't go into that. But so there are games in Italy that use lots of complex images. But someone creates a pack, and this is where the anachronistic bit comes in. I have no idea. It's impossible to prove, except that it works incredibly. This is a form, a pack that actually happens to work superbly well with the image of the tree of life that is being developed. Because you get from the if you like, the archaic tree of life, which is the actual image of the tree with the Bennu bird inside it, they create this diagrammatic image of 10 circles, 10 spheres, they call them, and 22 paths. Doesn't appear openly in Europe for another century and a half, 16th, 17th century. We find the tree of Anathesius Kosher. There are earlier trees found in Judaism, but you see this. But this idea of the 32 paths of human experience, which relate to 10... In the earliest version, they relate to 10 numbers 1 to 10. That's part of the influence of Greek philosophy. They have 22 paths. There happen to be 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. So you have these numbers and letters coming together to create a shape, diagrammatic shape, that enables people to connect these ancient archetypes and to start to, again, to do the kind of work that would have happened in ancient Egypt. And it so happens that the number cards in the tarot pack run from ace to 10. And the major arcana, there are 22 major arcana. And there's no way to prove this. In fact, it always sounds a bit mad when I say it. But it, I know it works because I've worked on it for years. If you put the tarot in its classic form, maps completely onto the tree of life. You put the tarot trumps together with the 22 paths and they work. You put the number cards together with the spheres and they work. And there's a whole other process around the court cards, but we're going to do the court cards next time in the second workshop. There's too much to do in one. So I'm just going to give you a set of images, really, that come out that are the diagrammatic tree of life that kind of gets developed. So I'll just... And I'll explain them so that we have them. This way. This is the Tree of Life with the Tower of Trumps. I'm going to explain. No. No, I'm not saying that. But I'll explain in a moment. No, no, God, no. It does. I mean, it develops over time. They have their Hebrew names, which I will. The names of the planets. I'll explain it all. Just give me a second. I'll explain in a minute what the various things mean. Because this is. Yes, and one's bigger than another. How interesting. I wonder how that happened. Yeah. This way this time. It's a blank Tree of Life, which isn't not needed today, but we may need later. So I'm just throwing all this on you. I'm going to explain it all, but I just want to give it all to you, so you've got it. This one, you may do many things with that. You can do whatever you want with that, actually. That's the point.
Talking about the box and the
no,
so we're going from one box to the other and the snakes around it. That's the story.
Yeah.
The story about and
yes.
There's a box and box. And then you get to the bottom of it and there's the snake that's forever turning and there's the scorpion.
Yeah.
How many boxes were
there? I'll have to come back to you with that because I can't hold it in my mind. Why do you want to know how many boxes?
Because I was thinking seven somehow, and I was thinking about...
I don't know, really.
Seven's also...
I'd have to count them up, Clara. I don't think I know. Might be the last one, I don't know. Let's see.
She's wasted, isn't she, really?
Oh yeah, just doesn't stop coming. I think this is the last one, actually. So really, fear not. There you go, Lenny.
Thank you.